Today is May 23rd, 2009. This is Conduit. The panel is intellectual property.
Let's get started then. So let's start with introducing the panelists.
I'll go first.
I'm Bob Defendi. I have written for many various game companies using other people's IP. I have started a game company myself of my own, so I have to deal with other people wanting to use that material and those IP. And I write short stories and novels.
Okay. I'm Elliot Setzer. I was a graduate student doing computer science stuff, but I know all kinds of computer science stuff, and I want to connect intellectual property to that. But I also have a lot of experience being really paranoid about intellectual property.
Intellectual property is scary.
So are you in the relation to Steve Setzer?
He's my son.
Yeah.
So you two are related.
Okay. I'm Dave Wolverton / Dave McFarland, and I a few years ago I made up business cards for myself, and I couldn't decide what to call myself because writer does not really express what we do anymore. Okay? As a video game slot designer / movie producer / novelist / short story writer, I
tax accountant.
Yes. And I've also worked on stuff down there, and all sorts of weird things that people don't know about. But I look at myself as an intellectual property developer. Okay? That's what I called myself. And I was gonna do that, but that sounds really hoity-toity. And anyway, so somebody asked me what I do at Gen Con one day, and I said, oh, I'm an intellectual property developer. And they said, oh, I was just talking to this fellow named Michael Capobianco. That's what he does, too. And of course, the joke is that we're both science fiction writers, primarily. But we both came to the same conclusion that doesn't really work anymore as a description for what we're doing.
In Michael's case, it's hoity-toity. In your case, it's prep.
That's nice. Thank you.
I'm Lee Modisit. I sort of fall in a different set of cracks because my intellectual property ranges from technical articles to statistical articles to science fiction writing to poetry, but I don't have any games, and I don't have any stuffed animals, so.
Okay. But except for the ones he collects on his own.
So
those are real animals.
So I
do have a large collection of dogs and several cats to go back.
So I do have a question for the panel. What exactly is it, the description of what this panel is about? I mean, I've got a little thing on here that says intellectual property. What are we supposed to talk about?
I think it's protecting your own and working with other people's. Copyright can be tricky. Learn how to protect your creations and how to avoid infringing on those of others.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
How about learning how to keep others from infringing on you?
I think that's a good cola.
Yeah. Well, who would like to start? Do you want to start on this? Protecting yourself from copyright.
I try to avoid it.
You try to avoid infringing and try to avoid being protected.
I try to avoid protecting.
Avoid copyright.
No, I mean,
go under the
I don't think the Berne Convention is a good idea because I work all the time against it. The Berne Convention is the thing that makes everything be copyrighted by default. Makes everything be copyrighted by default.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's the, all the treaties that are signed in the United States.
So you're the Creative Commons guy?
It's
kind of a tricky business. A lot of people are really afraid of trying to get things copyrighted. They're afraid of
sending things. You know, I've had people who, you know, say, oh, I want to write a novel. I say, oh, what's it about? They're like, oh, I'm not going to tell you. I know what you do. You know, you steal my great idea.
Oh my gosh.
You know, but that happens a lot. And the truth is that when you write something nowadays, it's under what's called the presumed copyright or assumed copyright law, which basically says that until it's copyrighted, we're going to give you copyright protection anyway. With the idea that as long as you can prove that you're the creator, it's protected by copyright law. And so there's not a lot of problems that way. There are people who do steal copyrights. There was a fellow in Montana that was a college writing instructor a few years ago who was caught stealing the novels and short stories of his students and then passing them off as his own work and getting them published. He moved to a college in California where I understand he was doing the same thing. And when you consider how many college professors there are, that's not a huge problem. And I don't think that most publishers have too many problems with it. In the last couple of years, I've seen a little rash of them, though. In one case, a young lady was paid couple hundred thousand dollars to be the next Christopher Paolini, and apparently she wasn't up to the task, and so she just started, you know, copying things verbatim out of other people's novels and running with that.
I remember
that. Yeah, that was kind of nasty. And then there was that one romance writer.
Janet Daly.
Who was it?
Janet Daly.
Janet Daly? Okay. I'll take your word for it, and who apparently, from what I understand, was going through fits of depression and sort of felt like she was losing her ability to write, and so she started copying reams of data out of some unknown romance author's works, much smaller romance author's works, which is the bizarre thing. Okay, that's the twist. When the New York Times bestseller starts copywriting things from some other author, some writer's writer.
Well, that's what that guy was afraid of with you. You're way bigger than me. You can get this published before I can.
That kind of thing happens. And, you know, usually it's the other way around. It's the little guy that we have to worry about somebody stealing our work.
Or stealing has sensed your name.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why I'm very leery about reading anybody else's work is an experience I had a number of years ago when a writer in Las Vegas basically sent me something. I'd met him at a couple of places and said, would you take a look at this? Mm-hmm. And I wrote a critique on what he wrote. And one of the lines I put in it is, in the letter that I sent him was, you've got the beginning of a rip-roaring story here, but you've got a lot of problems. And you need to address this, 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 and this. Typical what have you. Well, he self-published the novel with the blurb that said, Ellie Modisett says this is a rip-roaring story. It may be a little gun-shy, because, yes, I did use the words rip-roaring, mm-hmm. but not in that context.
Yeah. I was at a convention a couple of years ago, and Orson Scott Card was there, and he had just completed a novel, and he put the manuscript in a box and set it on a chair in front of him on one of the seats. And I was sitting behind these two teenagers, and they started talking, and one of them says, did you see that? He's got a novel just sitting right there. And the other one says, oh, how much do you think it's worth? And the first guy says, I don't know. $1 million? $2 million? And everyone's going, oh my God, do you think, nobody's looking. I mean, do you think if we could take it, you know, they'd see us? And it was just so funny. I mean, it was sad. You know, the really great thing about it was they turned out to be noble enough to resist the temptation to steal a $2 million manuscript that was sitting there. But it did really wake me up to, you know, to the fact that I shouldn't leave manuscripts or my typewriter or my laptop sitting around anywhere, because I'm putting other people under that kind of stress. I know that some of them won't fare as well. but yeah, that's the worst case I have of stories to tell.
I think Elliot probably has really interesting stuff to say about this.
well, also, yes, no, I mean, okay, I guess I should say about what you were saying about the person self-publishing and quoting your quote on. I mean, I don't know. Well, so I've done a lot of projects just in computer science about this, you know, concept of web annotation.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I mean, you know, isn't really that, I mean, it's not really that different from just the web itself, but, I mean, people complain a lot about web annotation because you can make it appear like you can draw stuff on somebody else's site. And no, I mean, but it would also protect you because you could go and say, I didn't mean this or whatever, if it was published on it.
What is web annotation? That's not a term that
It's kind of obscure because you can kind of achieve the same things in other ways without having quite as much infrastructure as web annotation. It's just where, you have one website and then you have a database somewhere that you can give the URL of that website to, and the database will send you, a list of stuff that annotates that document written by anybody.
I see. Okay.
And so it's sort of like, there are different implementations, but sometimes it's just like Wikipedia where all the entries are.
It allows people to give reviews of your books, for example, or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean,
basically, it sounds like a remote reference base, so to speak.
It could be. There are probably better ways to do it than to have a whole system like this. But
what's the point?
Yeah. you can correct errors in other people's lives.
Or introduce errors.
Yes, you can.
You can't prevent people from using it, but they don't really use it.
I always love to watch Wikipedia. When you read the Wikipedia article, you read the article, and then go back and see what people are arguing about as one of the salient points that, did Andrew Jackson really do this or that?
Right.
And very often, that's where you get the really fun information, is by ignoring the article and going back and listening to the scholars, battling it out.
I read the background stuff on their leprosy article once, because it said it was flagged as being potentially inaccurate. And man, they were just going nuts over arguing the disease and its implications and its manifestations, stuff like that. The reason why I point out Elliot, though, is were you saying that you try to avoid the whole copyright protection thing? That was probably an interesting subject for you to touch on.
I'm looking at your website and I saw you're on the panel. I noticed that you put a reading of your book up there. I don't know, there are definitely reasons for people just to put stuff up, like that, without even thinking about it.
You put it up on the website to gain an audience. One article simply said, the biggest battle that I have in my career right now is with obscurity, Getting people to have access to your work and get a sample of it, for example, is really an important thing for an author to do.
Well, Scott Sigler is just doing marvelous career things with it.
Who is this?
Scott Sigler, he's the first to my knowledge, the first person to put up a podcast audiobook.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't great, I'm going to say. It wasn't great. I was listening to it last, not this last LTU, the one before, and I would complain about it every time I'd come in. But he built up an audience with that because he was the first one to ever do it.
Yeah.
And then he put out another book and another book and another book, and he put out a book I just listened to called The Rookie, which is a science fiction novel about football that takes place 600 years in the future. And his writing isn't great yet, but that was a great story, and I really loved it. And he got picked up by Crown, I think, for it. And part of the reason was he was putting stuff out there. He was getting self-published stuff on Amazon. At the same time, the New York Times released an article about him. So they started calling people, all these publishers started calling his agent to find out about the New York Times article because he was doing this podcast audiobook thing. So all of a sudden there was a bidding war over him. While at the same time he got, I can't remember, it wasn't Fark or Dig, but it was one of those big sites where, you know, you get mentioned and it plugs you. That shot his Amazon book right up to one in one day. And now he's just doing great, just because it's all the buzz from this audiobook stuff. And so far, releasing everything under Creative Commons, which is what I think he does, I haven't heard of him.
Corey Doctorow was sort of really one of the first people to do a book with Creative Commons, right? And I mean, the book that he happened to do was also really interesting for its future interpretation.
Creative Commons is a license that you can get. There's Creative, I think it's creativecommons.com, and there are different versions of the license for what you want to do. For instance, Jonathan Colton puts out all of his stuff on Creative Commons, and he's pretty liberal in what you do with it as long as you don't make money off of it. And that you attribute them. So there'll be like versions where you'll be like, well, you can't alter it in any way, you can't use it for commercial use, and you can't use it without attributing it. But like Jonathan Colton says, you can alter it any way you want, you take snippets of it, do stuff like this, as long as you're not making money off of it. You know, as long as you say that I wrote it. And so that's why I use one of his songs in my podcast audiobook was to, as a closing credit song, just because why not? It's a great book, it's a great story, it fits the book well. So there are lots of different versions. The problem with Creative Commons, the negative side of Creative Commons is it has yet to be challenged in court, to my knowledge.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's no different than GPL.
Is it?
And I mean, GPL is for software, but I mean, it should be the same.
Some people have questions for us. Let's start taking questions.
Go ahead. Okay. This is directly pertinent to something that I'm involved in. Four people, I am now being asked to be the fourth. The concept is that of a audio production. It'll involve music, one person, fiction being read, another person, writer obviously, and then you have a production engineer who does all the production. Nobody in the group understands even where to start with how do we get all of our ducks in a row now so that when the project is hopefully doing something, there's not this stupid internecine war and everyone's pissed off at each other over rights and, hey, I want this money and I want that money and blah, blah, blah. We don't even know where to start.
Yeah.
How do you start researching that information?
You know, you have to, basically it has to come down to a contract between each one of you in the party, and you're going to have to, at some point, say, we're going to split this, you know, 70, 20, 10 or something like that, whatever you guys feel is right. And then you'll just each sign the contract. That's basically what you're going to have to do. And as far as copyright, you know, you may want to form a company and give it, you know, assign the copyright to the company, something like that.
And I don't know if anybody knows the answer to this question. The one thing that came up immediately off of that conversation, which we had, was when additional acting talent or voice talent is added, or additional music talent or additional writing talent that's not part of the four, you know, how do you figure that out? Because you can't say you get a percentage, you know, does it then become like, okay, for these four episodes that you're involved in, you get a certain amount, blah, blah, blah. Is there a book, like, is there a boilerplate book we could look at that's like, you know...
You mean example contracts?
Well, examples would be nice to look at, but something that would be, like, copyright for dummies. Is there such a thing as copyright for dummies?
Well,
for project work? And
I think what you're referring to, though, is just logistics of how much people should get. Like, what I would do in your circumstance is set aside a set percentage for actors every episode. Say they get 10% or whatever it is, and however many actors or however you want to divide it out, you know,
or
they
if you want to
split that same chunk each time.
Or if you want to make it a little more general,
just basically have, in essence, 10% to be reserved for additional costs.
Yeah.
And that gives you okay, it can be actors. If you need an additional engineer for something that's really technical, you can do that.
Yeah. Here's a way to get 1% to a cover artist if we need a cover all of a sudden.
Or you can go the other route, which is have the company own all the rights and pay the people who work on it work for hire.
Yeah.
Or you can go the convoluted route that Hollywood goes and points and procedures and this much of that and recognition in this way, shape, or form, and you can get as complicated as you want to dream.
I recommend giving everybody monkey points and taking all the money for yourself.
Except you have to start it up as a California corporation because you can't steal money that way the rest of the United States.
Back to the giving away your stuff, sort of. Last year or the year before, Dave Weber has been giving away CDs in the back of his books with the entire contents of the series on the CD. Mm-hmm. I asked him how it affected sales. So it went up. Apparently people like the thing in the bathtub.
Here's the genius of that plan, because no one's going to read those. I mean, maybe 1% of the people who get them are going to read from those CDs, but they give it perceived value. Because people don't like reading in front of computers. What's more likely to happen is people buy the book because they're like, oh, I can go back and read the whole series. They try reading a couple chapters, and then they decide, I like this book, but I'm hating reading it on my screen. I'm going to go back and get the hard copy of that book.
Right.
That's genius.
But what I was saying is it appears that in the software industry, which is more where I'm involved in, there's a trend toward giving away your software and turning it into donationware or whatever, and there seems to be a social trend toward, thank you for giving it to me, it's great stuff, here's $5 or $10 or $100 because you just saved me a week of having to write it myself. Is there any other trend like that in the writing industry?
I made 250 off my podcast audiobook. Just when I got done, I said, give me a dollar. You got a dollar. You don't need a dollar. Give me a dollar. Do I come to my site? You know what? I deserve a dollar. And I did this kind of funny post about it. And I had people, I'd be like, $27.93. They just sent me their whole PayPal account. <You know?
laughs> So, Bob, you're essentially saying that people do pay?
They do, not many, but I mean...
Enough to make it worth your while?
Enough to make me feel like people value the work.
Okay. But does it also work as advertising for your other stuff?
I would hope so. We're still a little new into it, but, you know, I look at Scott Singler and I say, somebody made it work. I look at Howard Taylor. Howard Taylor's one who suggested I do it because, you know, he makes his living off of giving stuff away for free, and then... charging it for it later, and it's working well for him.
Well, I was talking to Howard about this just a little while ago, and Howard made the point that, in essence, he makes pretty much of his living off of the hard copy,
right,
the Schlock Mercenary books. Mm-hmm. Basically, people see the day-to-day comics, and he makes some money off the buttons and the T-shirts and what have you that go with it, but most of the money comes off of a hard publication. And in essence, he's created an infrastructure which creates a buzz, as Bob was talking about. Mm-hmm. So when he puts out the actual Schlock Mercenary printed books, mm-hmm. the audience is ready for them. They really want to see it all in one place. And that's where it comes from. And I think that in terms of what you were talking about earlier, I think in terms of fiction as opposed to, say, software, we're still at the point where most of the things that you're talking about in terms of, call it freeware or free CDs or what have you, are mainly teasers. I mean, if you look at what Bain puts out, and they're the biggest publisher of the free CDs and what have you, it's mainly teasers. I mean, Tor does it occasionally. They put one of my books, Flash, out as a free download on Amazon or a free, what have you, an e-book. I can't say that it helps sales very much. But I don't know. It certainly didn't help sales very much on that particular book. On the other hand, in the last 2 years or 3 years since I've been operating a full-scale website, it's pretty clear that a number of what I would call web readers, as opposed to book readers, have suddenly discovered that I'm there, because I can tell from the online postings and the chattering and what have you, that that particular group of people is showing more interest. Now, for me, I'm in a little bit different state than either Dave or Bob, because my readers have traditionally been hard book readers. The electronic community has not been, or was not initially, a very large percentage component of my readers. And so for me to go to the electronic presence and the website has definitely been a positive, in the sense that it has brought in more readers from that particular area. Now, in terms of the intellectual property side of it, I do it a little bit differently. I don't post any fiction on the website. I basically post original articles and commentaries, often with fairly substantial research behind them, that make people think about things. That's my way of dealing with it. And I don't care. I mean, I sort of grant people what amounts to a Creative Commons license. If somebody asks if they can repost it, it's, yes, you can, as long as you don't make money out of it. As long as it's not for commercial purposes, you're perfectly free to repost this or what have you. But I've got sort of a double firewall there, in the sense that they don't get access to fiction. So if somebody does misuse the, call it technical or commentary stuff that I publish, it's not going to hit me in the pocketbook.
Yeah, I don't know. Brandon has Warbringer, which
I don't. I think it's like. Some it's soon. It's like
June.
June. Sometime in June, yeah, like June 9th or something.
Okay.
So I figured, you know, I'm kind of holding off, you know, reserving judgment on giving away your fiction for free on the internet and stuff until I see how that does. I'm interested to see how it affected the sales and stuff. But there are authors out there who have posted free books on blogs. They've posted, given free copies away, they've tried self-publishing electronically, and been able to generate enough buzz by doing those types of things that they were then able to turn that into, you know, good money by getting decent contracts.
That's how Scalzi was.
Yeah, Scalzi started that way, and which has got Brandon thinking, okay, I'm just going to go ahead and write a book and let people read it, and, you know, and then we'll go out and put it out and see if that creates any extra buzz for it. And I think that's a great idea. With certain books, maybe, you know, if you've got a book that you want to try that with, you know, I don't see a tremendous amount of harm with it, unless, of course, somebody picks it up and tries to sell it their own, in which case, you know, you're just giving away your entire book. But, you know, the fact that you had it posted on your website means that you'll be able to backtrack and show it to your creator anyway, so.
Yeah, when I did Death by Cliché, I didn't want to use the Creative Commons because I wasn't 100% convinced of the legalities of it. So, every podcast has a copyright notice in it, but on the other hand, I've given it away for free. So, the patiobooks.com was asking me about it. They're like, well, we'll post it. They haven't yet. But they're like, we'll post it as long as you're not going to go after people for like copying, making copies, giving it to your friends. And I'm like, that'd be kind of silly. if they can download it for free from your site or my site, I really don't mind if they give it to a friend for free. You know? Now, if they transcribe it all and print it, that might be an issue.
There are authors who get terribly worried about that kind of thing. If I put it on my, you know, if I put it on there, people will print it off and steal it. Okay, well,
you know, you just figure out the cost of how much it takes to copy off a 500 to 600 page book, you know, at 6 cents a page, times, you know, you're talking $36 maybe to print it. You know, they might sort of go buy it when it comes out. It's going to be cheaper. I have known people who stole books that way. I remember some young kid that was like 17 years old that came up to me at a convention once and was offering to, you know, hey, I'll give you a copy of so-and-so's book, you know, that I made. And I'm like, well, first of all, it's ugly and unwieldy because you made it out of a copy machine. But also, did you just think about the fact that you just, you know, spent $15 stealing this book?
Yeah, exactly.
There's
a big thing.
Probably did it on the school copier.
Right.
Something like that, you know.
But that is one advantage we do have as authors. And we are right now in a situation where most people still want to read books on paper. I mean, I can look at my sales. Yes, I sell some e-books. And the progression has been, very frankly, 3 years ago, maybe I sold 10 e-books out of all 50 plus books I had at that point. Well, now we're up into the hundreds, the low hundreds. But I think it's going to probably be another 5 to 10 years before e-books really are a significant fraction of those books out there. Now, Kindle may help because it's a wide platform that a lot of people go to, but I think there's still going to be a large percentage of the population that simply doesn't want to bother with it. If you can get a paperback for $6, $8.99 or $7.99 that can go in the sand and the beach and everything else, there are going to be times you don't want to take your Kindle or your ebook reader to this place or that place.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a while before that changes, and I don't think it's ever going to totally go away. I think what is going to happen, and we're seeing this in terms of book sales, is comparatively speaking, paperback sales are declining, they're mass markets. Hard book sales of well-known authors are rising in comparison. They're still less, but they're rising in comparison to paperback books. I think we may see a bifurcation in the market along these lines in the future, in the sense of more hardback books sold, especially from well-known authors, less paperback books, and the e-books pulling into that paperback slot.
I think that might actually happen.
Well, yeah, I mean, especially because I'm looking at it right now, if I go into Amazon and buy a hardbound book, I make more money than I did 15 years ago, but I think if you adjust for inflation, I'm kind of pretty close to, you know, because the books haven't been going up in price very much, but inflation has. I'm kind of pretty close to paying the same amount, you know, adjusted for inflation as I was for paperbacks, you know, 15 years ago.
You are. And realistically, we, you know, if you adjust for the cost of inflation, book prices haven't really been going up.
Yeah. But getting back to the whole intellectual property thing, which is where we supposedly started, I think to a certain degree, fiction authors are a little bit more protected by the economics of the situation than, say, software developers are or music developers are.
Yeah.
And the music industry has just been obliterated in certain segments because of, call it the MP3 and all of that.
It's been pretty much trashed everywhere. I don't know.
Well, I can't remember the last time I listened to anything on something the music industry tries to sell me. You know, I don't listen to CDs anymore. I don't listen to, you know, it's all my iPod. You know? If I could buy a CD, I just transfer it to my iPod. You know, it's just an extra step of annoyance.
Which means that in essence, the music industry is going to be going much more to CDs of a very special nature, call it classical music.
I was going to say classical may be the only holdout where, you know, because most classical music is going to want to listen to a real long piece of music. Although I could do that on an iPod too.
But the problem is that they're, even with a very fast computer, if you're talking downloading a 1 hour Beethoven symphony, you're taking a hell of a lot of bandwidth even on high speed.
And I have to be honest here. I've always been into high end stereos, but so far, iPods don't do it for me. Quite frankly, CDs don't do it for me.
The real hardcore audio heads, they still use the old analog CDs with the tube amplifiers because you're able to get the ambiance, whereas with the CDs and stuff, you don't get any of that anymore.
I still have my old, you know, phonographic master discs and stuff, but I need to go back and... Nobody uses that anymore.
Well, one of the things about it, this is probably nothing to do with intellectual property, but one of the things to do with that is music, especially classical music, depends on the overtones as well as the straight tones. When you go to digital master, you basically wipe out most of the overtones.
You're absolutely right.
So it doesn't have the same feel as either being in the hall or with one of the old vinyls, which basically reproduces all sounds, whether they were meant to be there or not.
Right. All of which, you know, has everything to do with intellectual properties.
Well, yeah, we're almost at the 340 mark. I should probably hit the other side of this with other people's intellectual property and working with that.
Yeah.
Well,
you know, working with Lucasfilm or with Mummy or with Starcraft or anything like that, whenever you have a contract with one of those people, you sign a little statement saying, I hereby, you know, for X dollars, usually, or X percentage of the work, I sign away all rights to this throughout all eternity in all forms, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And for that reason, you know, when George Lucas did Star Wars Episode 1, if you go look at the Star Wars comic books that Kevin Anderson did, you'll see a picture of a guy, you know, dressed up like an ancient Jedi Knight. And you'll notice that the exact outfit has been duplicated in Episode 1 with our first introduction of the Jedi Knight. And you'll also see things like the double-sided lightsaber and things like that. In Episode 1, I had written a couple of years previous to it a scene in which I had some characters was trying to escape across a lake on a boat and having these giant fish jumping up and trying to get them. And I saw, you know, some corollaries there. And basically, as I started talking to other authors, you know, 15 or 20 other Star Wars authors in a room, they said, yeah, he took this from mine and this from mine. And that's a lot of what George Lucas does. He's basically, he bought those intellectual properties. Why does he need to go, you know, trouble his head trying to come up with something completely new? When he wanted to use aliens in his in the movie, I understand that he went into a room and he said, what aliens have been approved for use, you know, elsewhere, and you know, that maybe haven't been seen before? And so he did this one in this comic, and he got this, and they have a list of 120 aliens, and he says, that one, that one, that one, that one, that one. And that's how they create the aliens. You know, he liked the looks of those. He already approved them. And so, in a sense, you know, he was utilizing skills as a story borrower. And, you know, instead of getting upset about that and going, you know, he violated my rights or anything, it's sort of like, no, I sold those rights to him, and I'm really glad that he liked them well enough to include them in something. You know, that's the way that it should be.
I mean, in a way, that's a lot like Creative Commons, except it's just, you know, George Lucas is better at Creative Commons.
Yeah.
And so, I mean...
But he paid for them.
He paid for them.
And that there is a difference.
George Lucas owns that property. You know, authors, some authors were complaining that, you know, when George Lucas cut down the amount that he was willing to pay per novel, you know, so the authors weren't making hundreds of thousands on a Star Wars book, but they were only making $60,000 or $80,000. I was going, you know, that's still a good pay for 3 months worth of work.
It really is.
you know, I'm not going to. And the big thing was, it was his money. You know, it wasn't ours to demand or scream about or cry about or anything, which some people in, you know, civil science fiction writers in America went so far as to put up an ad in the New York Times and stuff like that, complaining that he was a criminal. And, you know, and anyway,
wait a second. He owns Star Wars.
Yes.
Lock, stock, and barrel.
Yes. And he was a criminal for not giving the money to them.
Okay. That's what I thought you said.
primarily because, you know, they're poor, hungry authors, and therefore they deserve it somehow. I don't go for that.
If you're a poor, hungry author, go write your own damn book.
I'm just saying, look, you know, hey, see what he did? Do it better. Go make your own Star Wars. You know.
Well, 60 to 80,000 is a lot more than you probably would have made up your first stone damn book.
I did a Star Wars novel, you know, in the early days, and I got paid pretty well for it.
Yeah.
And I still make, you know, 2,000 a year off of it.
Like Courtship?
Yeah, Courtship, yeah. And,
yeah, I mean, that kind of thing is exactly what happens all the time in software. You know, because many of these companies that have, this is our own. Software or whatever. That's just, you know.
Can you comment on the SEO lax?
SEO claims to. That's the kind of. That's a lot closer to the type of paranoia that I even have.
But it's
SEO is the company which. Presumably originally started in Santa Cruz, but then moved over to Linden, Utah, and they had, through a long history of releasing various versions of Unix, supposedly gotten rights to the original expression of certain parts of the Unix API or something. And then they claimed that this expression of the implementation of the Unix API was the code of the API in Linux. They claimed that the code was the same as their code, but they didn't actually have any evidence of this. And
there was a long court suit, and they lost, as I recall.
Yeah, and I mean, IBM had to defend markets because they other companies like to use Linux. If I wasn't thinking so much about alternatives to intellectual property, then I wouldn't be nearly as concerned about intellectual property as an issue, because, it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy or self-fulfilling paranoia or whatever, because, the problem is that, if you're trying to think about alternatives to the system, the people who are in charge of the system are a lot more likely to come after you if you do something. But, it's kind of, and I mean, that's exactly like what Linux is doing. Linux is an alternative to the traditional Unix closed source model, and, they came after Unix for, they came after Linux for completely minor things. So,
Teacher.
How about intellectual property rights and out of print stuff? For example, the Gutenberg Project, before they changed copyright laws, was busy saying, author died, this is written 75 years ago, presto, we can now make it available to the world, and this work will not be lost. Disney made that change, so that you now have to do all sorts of other stuff to figure out whether the copyright's alive or dead or not. With your own work...
Disney's genius.
With your own works...
We were arguing about this earlier.
What would prefer to happen to your works when the copyright does expire, whatever the formula is at that time.
Disney's older than me. I don't think it's going to happen. They're just going to keep on changing the laws to protect themselves.
I'm going to take a riff on this because I actually have an instance where it sort of occurred. I've got a book coming out in about 3 weeks called Hayes, and I wanted to quote a line from T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets. And I basically wanted to quote it and attribute it to Eliot. I didn't want to steal it or anything. I just thought it was really in character for the character to quote Eliot. It's not in the final version of the book, because the line was published after 1923, and the Eliot estate patrols all copyrights, and you have got to pay money. Well, I'm sorry. I don't want to pay money, and neither does my publisher, to quote one line of T.S. Eliot. Now, the downside of this is most kids today and most readers don't even know who the hell T.S. Eliot is. So by the rigid protection of copyright under this sort of thing, and the demand for I'm going to get my pound of flesh no matter what. Let's face it. I sell many thousands of copies of books. More copies of probably of my books are in print right now than any of T.S. Eliot's. And you want me, you
want me to pay you money to cite you so that people might actually read T.S. Eliot?
Preeminent. What you should do is you should have written a letter to the state saying, I would like to use this, and if I do use it, I'd like you to pay me an advertising fee as compensation.
According to my publisher's attorneys, that's been tried, and the Eliot estate is not amenable to this sort of thing.
So the real question is, what would you like your estate to do?
I already told my estate, if anybody wants to quote two lines from me, be my guest. I mean, there's a big difference between attribution and short, what we used to call fair usage.
Yeah, yeah.
And stealing. I mean, fair usage, if it's two lines of poetry or a couple of sentences from prose, that's advertising. It's advertising for whoever it happens to be, if it's attributed to the music. And yet, we've got this fight going on in terms of intellectual property of you can't do anything unless you pay for it. And on the other side, everything ought to be open. Well, life is not like that. We really need some provisions for gray. And they aren't there.
There's a legal point here I want to point out without taking the side. The fair use laws are hard to use with poetry and songs. Because the point is that if you're presenting people with something that's a small enough chunk about the work that doesn't reduce the value of that work, then you're allowed to use it. Well, songs and poetry, every line is so important to the whole that you have a hard time using fair use.
Yeah. Okay, but I mean, even if you're sure that you would win the fair use lawsuit, you still don't want to fight the fair use lawsuit.
That's why that line is not in the book. Because basically, the Macmillan Tour attorney said, we don't want to fight this. Yes, we can win it. We don't want to fight it. Please fix it.
Did they tell you how much it would cost for the line?
No.
I mean, to fight the lawsuit.
No, I mean, how much did they sell you the line for?
And so it wasn't huge. It was several hundred dollars for one line. But I have a problem paying several hundred dollars to advertise T.S. Eliot.
No, I'm with you. I'm just curious.
So, well, my other question,
the question was, what do we want done with us? I don't care. I'm dead. You know, what's that? Yeah, I don't care. You know, people can, you know, I guess that, you know, ideally I'll say I want my children to be able to make money off of my estate for as long as it's legally possible. And hopefully they'll keep my books in print. And I would like them to, you know, if the Rune Lords is big enough that people want to do, turn it into a huge franchise and make movies and, you know, do anthologies and stuff, great, go for it. So I'm not the kind of person who says everything that I've done is immortal and you know, no word may ever be changed or, you know, published.
Yeah. I'm kind of the same way. I mean, I'm with both of you on this. You're probably with each other. I'd like my estate to make as much money off stuff I do as possible. But like Lee say, you know, if it helps the value of the estate, goodness sakes, give it away for free. You know, there's a reason to spark a savvy marketing business person in charge of that to make those calls because
you put T.S. Eliot quotes on T-shirts and you know selling T-shirts.
advertising is a good thing.
What about the book that you currently can't get in print because it's not that good, but it was still part of your?
But that's one thing that maybe I'd want to see just killed. You know,
actually, I did.
You say it's not killed, or you did something with it?
No, I wrote, I have to admit, most people don't know this, I mentioned earlier today, but most people don't know this. I wrote an absolutely abysmal mystery novel when I was writing science fiction stories. And it was so damn bad that I destroyed every ounce of it. It will never show up because there are no copies anywhere. And I think in answer to the question, if you've got something that bad as a writer and you don't want it out there, it's your duty to get rid of it before anybody else can.
Yeah.
Or confront it.
Yeah, when I first started getting my novels published, I came across some manuscripts that I'd written when I was 17, partial manuscripts where I got, you know, 10 chapters into a book or something like that. And so I just went out in the backyard and had a little fire going out. Yep, my wife comes out and says, oh my God, what are you doing?
So you're saying, in other words, if a book is not worth being in print, you probably want to destroy it anyway.
Yeah. And actually, there are books that I do have. I do have a book that I think deserves to be in print, and I just haven't pushed it. That it had some problems, and that I wrote it when I was working with a gaming company. And so so they control the intellectual property, and recently they gave it back to a friend of mine, and now I'm probably in a position where I can go ahead and put it out, but then I have to come up with an agreement where we split the property between me and him. And I'm just like, I go write another book in the time that it takes me. So, you know, I think it's a worthy project. Always did, always will, but at the same time, so I'm not going to destroy it.
If I know I'm going to die, and I'm rich enough that I'm worried about the estate stuff like that, or popular enough, I would probably write a foreword for all of my bad books in my estate and say, you cannot publish this book without this foreword in there, or say, hey, this book is bad. but I don't mind you reading it. If you read it, knowing this is my second book I ever wrote, and you're reading it to learn how I came to where I am.
Yeah.
I don't mind you.
The truth is, Bob comes across as very forceful. But you know something? He's a lot more humble than I am in this particular thing. I don't want anybody reading anything that I think is terrible.
Yeah, of course, the truth is, I don't know that I think that anything I've done is terrible. I recently read my first novel, and I was making some corrections on it after 20 years. So I was thinking, you might want to reprint this.
On my way to paradise.
Uh-huh. And then looking at it, I thought, well, this chapter's good. That chapter needed some work, you know. But all in all, compared to, I told my wife, I said, compared to a lot of most first novels that I see, this is pretty damn good. So I'm not going to apologize for it. I'll just say, yeah.
Well, like for me, and on leasing, for me, the a big step in me when I was a kid was reading Piers Anthony's But What of Earth? Because that's the book where he went through and he published the book. And he did it kind of a little spitefully in places. But he published the book and he published all the annotations that had been made in the book by all the people who had read it before it got completely changed and published in another author's name. And that experience of going through that book and reading all the annotations and his comments on them was just enlightening to me. And, and that's why I wouldn't mind, trying something like that for other people.
We're almost out of time here. Does anybody have a last question?
This is a paranoid question. I'm wondering about, some of us have the opportunity because of our work, where there's downtime, there's hours you can spend on the job. You can be writing, proofreading your stuff, what have you. You can even be doing this on company equipment. Is this a problem?
Yeah, that's
a cause.
I've been worried about that a lot recently. Okay. That's exactly, I'm looking for a job right now, and I'm thinking, I want one where I can be sure.
Is there a certain, in California, for example, I know a friend who turned out a job at a university because the intellectual invention that he created while he was at the university was going to be a property of the university. And therefore, the novel that he wrote, in theory, the university owned. And they proved that by suing one of their faculty members who wrote a novel and published it.
I ended up with WordPerfect, although WordPerfect was very nice about giving you exceptions. Yeah. But, I had a sign of things saying everything I write, period, while I worked at WordPerfect was theirs. And I went to HR and said, I write short stories. And they're like, oh, we didn't mean that to include short stories. We're talking about software. And they gave me an exception for that.
Same thing about. Yeah.
Well, I think we're done.
All right.